I next met with Dr. Emily Bergsland to talk mainly about neuroendocrine cancers, and to begin, she commented on the taxonomy of this disease.
Over the past 5 years, there's become a greater appreciation for the differences between pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors and other common types, such as the traditional carcinoid tumor. We now have two FDA-approved drugs for pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, sunitinib and everolimus, neither of which have shown proven efficacy in carcinoids. So I think there's an increasing understanding for the need to distinguish between the two in patients. Historically, these diseases were lumped together, and it's only been in the recent clinical trials that people have started really looking at these diseases as separate entities. And in general, pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors seem to be more responsive to therapy. It doesn't necessarily mean that these agents won't work in carcinoid. It just means that we may need to be more careful about the trial design and the endpoints. The agents that have shown activity in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor, there's a biological basis for thinking why they might have activity in a disease like carcinoid. And there are ongoing studies looking at both mTOR inhibitors as well as VEGF inhibitors in carcinoid. One example is SWOG-0518, which was a large randomized phase 3 study looking at octreotide LAR plus bevacizumab versus octreotide LAR plus interferon in patients with high-risk non-pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. And that study is fully accrued and the results are pending, so that will be interesting. There's also another study, Radiant-4, which is ongoing right now, which is everolimus progressive non-functional neuroendocrine tumors. And that will also be informative. Again, non-pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors.
And another question I've heard from oncologists is the role of octreotide. Can you comment on that and the questions you hear about that agent?
Yeah, I think that actually is also another confusing area. It's been known for a long time, and octreotide is, of course, approved for the use for symptom control in patients with elevated hormone levels and in carcinoid. And we know that it does a very good job of controlling hormone-mediated symptoms, but it was only fairly recently that we had randomized data to suggest there was actually an anti-tumor effect, and that was from the PROMID study, which was published in 2009. Now, that study was actually in patients with mid-gut tumors, well-differentiated mid-gut tumors, or tumors of unknown primary, and it did show an improvement in progression-free survival, but a couple of the caveats associated with this study are, number one, it was a fairly small study. It was stopped after an interim analysis. They were unable to show an overall survival benefit, which is not surprising because we would expect that many of the patients originally assigned to placebo would have had octreotide at some other point in their illness. The other thing is these patients were not required to have progression at the time of study entry. So it's still unclear what the optimal timing for using octreotide. You know, I think there's good data in that group of patients that it delays tumor growth, but whether you need to start it right at the time of diagnosis or whether it's okay to wait until progression is an unanswered question.
And what about octreotide in pancreatic NET?
Also unanswered. Not only pancreatic NET, but carcinoids arising in places like the bronchial tree or the rectum were not included in that study either. So I think we don't yet have data as to whether there's a true cytostatic effect in those populations, but there is a study called the Clarinet study, the results of which are pending, which looks at a related somatostatin analog, lanreotide, in patients that have well-differentiated tumors, including pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors that are non-functional.
When you look at the spectrum of GI NET tumors, where do you see specific endocrine issues and what kinds of issues?
Well, I think it's fair to say that neuroendocrine tumors of almost any subtype may or may not make hormones, and patients may or may not be symptomatic from the hormones that their tumors make. So generally speaking, only a subset of patients will have tumors that make hormones, and then of those patients, not all patients are symptomatic. So, for example, in carcinoid, a subgroup of patients will have elevated serotonin levels, which is generally measured using urinary 5-HIA levels. And of those patients, some are asymptomatic and some are symptomatic, and the symptoms are typically things like flushing and diarrhea and palpitations. We tend to call the symptomatic patients patients that have a functional tumor. And then similarly, in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, there are patients who might have elevations of hormones like pancreatic polypeptide, insulin, gastrin, glucagon. And of those patients, some of the patients will have an actual functional syndrome from those hormones, meaning that they actually cause effects like hypoglycemia in patients with high insulin levels or ulcers in patients with high gastrin levels.
What about the workup of a patient with a GI NET tumor in terms of these specific assays? Is there a panel that you typically do, or how do you approach it in a patient who's asymptomatic?
I think that's a really good question, and it probably varies from one doctor to the next. My own style is in a patient in whom I suspect a typical carcinoid tumor, a well-differentiated tumor, for example, of the small bowel, I will usually do a baseline 24-hour urine 5-HIA to see whether there's any evidence of hormone production. And if there is, whether or not the patient's symptomatic, I'll use that during the course of their illness just to be one other indicator of disease status. I also tend to do the chromogranin in the blood as well, again, just as a marker to follow during the course of the illness. And that's important because in those patients, I tend to make decisions about treatment based on not only the markers, but also how the patient is doing clinically, as well as changes radiographically, and sort of integrate all that information to make decisions about whether there's been progression.
What about markers in pancreatic NET in the asymptomatic patient?
Yeah, I think in the asymptomatic patient, there are no firm recommendations other than I think most would draw a chromogranin. I think pancreatic polypeptide is a very reasonable marker to draw because that often can be elevated and not cause any, it's typically not associated with any symptoms. So just in terms of looking for a marker to follow, that's a reasonable one to draw. Sometimes I'll draw a panel of markers when I have an unknown primary and I'm uncertain what organ is the site of origin. And in those patients, I might, in addition to do a 24-hour urine 5-HIA, I might also draw a gastrin, a glucagon, pancreatic polypeptide, just to see if it gives some hints as to the potential site of origin.
Any myths or misperceptions that you see in the management of GI NET tumors, including localized ones, as you see patients sort of coming into you for second opinions?
Well, I think one that's not very common but is really important to acknowledge is to understand that high-grade tumors are very different than low-grade tumors. Sometimes we see patients with low-grade tumors treated with platinum-based chemotherapy, like a high-grade tumor, and yet we know that those are very unlikely to respond to that type of therapy. And then similarly, sometimes we see patients with high-grade tumors that have been treated with things like everolimus or sunitinib that would be traditionally expected to work in, for example, a well-differentiated pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor. So I think sometimes there's confusion about the differences between high-grade and low-grade tumors and the fact that high-grade tumors are really typically traditionally treated according to small cell lung cancer algorithms. The other area might be, I think it's just an area of confusion, not so much a myth, is just sort of understanding the role of resection in the patient with metastatic disease. And I think there we're really lacking randomized data to guide us. But I think that in patients with isolated liver metastases, for example, we will often consider resection of the tumors. But I think increasingly it's becoming apparent that that may not be a curative approach. There are some data now suggesting fairly high recurrence rates as you get out as far as 10 years, suggesting that it may set the clock back for patients and may allow a nice disease-free interval, a time where they're hopefully symptom-free. But even in the setting of a complete resection, it's not clear that it's curative.
Same thing in terms of RFA, for example?
Yeah. I think the role of RFA or other local therapies like embolization remains fairly controversial. These are all techniques that are widely used and applied in both pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors as well as carcinoid, but the field suffers from lack of randomized data, so knowing whether one particular modality is better than another is very difficult to know.
This kind of reminds me of doing an interview on T-cell lymphoma. You know, I'm trying to even ask intelligent questions. I can only imagine what it's like for an oncologist trying to take care of these people. I know there are a lot of questions that people have about optimal sequencing of systemic agents. I want to ask you, in terms of your sort of algorithm for how you think that through, but also what the role is of just withholding therapy and observing the patient.
I actually think there definitely is a role in observing the patient. I think the challenge in a newly diagnosed patient is that you only have one time point on the curve. And that's always really hard in somebody who's newly diagnosed and you don't have previous scans and you don't know the pace of the disease. But in somebody who doesn't have bulky disease or isn't particularly symptomatic, I think there definitely is a role for potentially observing the patient. And what I do is a short interval follow-up scan. So I'll often do one after 2 or 3 months just so I have a second point on the curve and can get a sense as to the pace of the disease. It's tough because well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumors can behave in very different ways in different patients. So some patients can clearly have really indolent disease and in some cases be followed for some years without any specific intervention. And in other cases, patients have much more aggressive disease. But I think, again, with close monitoring, it's very reasonable to watch somebody off therapy because patients in some cases do very well with no treatment at all. And the current NCCN guidelines are pretty clear about that there are a number of treatment interventions that can be considered. But for example, in the case of sunitinib and everolimus in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, those trials were both done in patients with progressive disease, and that was an important eligibility criterion to point out.
So what about the sequencing of agents? I'm not sure how you might break it down in terms of, you know, sort of the silos of directions that you can go, maybe starting out with pancreatic NET. How do you sort of globally look at the decision as to what therapy to start and particularly what your second and third line treatment might be?
This is a tough area because I would say that the treatment algorithm is really, it's individualized on a case-by-case basis, and it very much depends on the extent of disease, the location of disease, whether or not the patient has a functional tumor or is symptomatic from the tumor itself in terms of pain, for example. So in my case, considering all of those factors, first-line treatment might consist of anything from no therapy and observation in an asymptomatic patient to proceeding with resection if somebody had very limited disease. Although I would say that in the case of somebody with metastatic disease, we'll often at least try to watch somebody for a couple of months before we embark on a large operation to get a sense of the pace of the disease. Two, sometimes we'll consider chemotherapy up front. In somebody with bulky symptomatic disease, we will consider chemotherapy. And unfortunately, while we're lacking randomized prospective data with temozolomide-based regimens, I think those are widely used in the disease and do appear to have activity. So I tend to use capecitabine and temozolomide. And then, of course, there are the biologics. And I think everolimus or sunitinib are also reasonable considerations in somebody with progressive pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor in whom you feel that there's an indication for therapy.
How do you choose between those two?
I tend to do it based on a patient's comorbidities and preference. The side effect profiles are somewhat different. With everolimus, you can get a worsening of hyperglycemia. So if somebody has underlying diabetes that's not particularly well controlled, I might opt against that. Sunitinib, of course, has a higher risk of hypertension. And so in somebody who already has baseline hypertension that's not particularly well controlled, I would opt against using sunitinib first line. I think both drugs have an indication in the disease, and unfortunately, we don't have data to help guide us in terms of sequence. There hasn't been a trial done looking at comparing the use of everolimus followed by sunitinib or sunitinib followed by everolimus. So at this point, it really is left up to provider and patient preference.
You talked about everolimus and diabetes. Can you kind of talk about what we know about the metabolic effects of everolimus?
Well, we know that it's intimately linked with metabolism. We know that there's actually some data, for example, in patients, there's some case reports of patients with insulinoma having improvements in their symptoms on everolimus. It has very pleiotropic effects in the body, affects IGF-1 receptor signaling. And it's well known in multiple trials with agents of this class that there's a risk of hyperglycemia. It often is readily treated, so it's not necessarily a problem that's prohibitive, but it's something that we need to be watching for in patients.
What about lipidemias?
Hyperlipidemia is the same thing. It's an unusual side effect that seems to be unique to this class of drugs and needs to be monitored while patients are on study.
So you see patients, for example, who come in, start everolimus, and then have problems with the glucose control who haven't had problems before?
Yeah, I think it's more common in patients who have underlying problems with glucose intolerance, but it is something that one needs to watch for while they're on drug.
So what about algorithms with carcinoid?
Well, in carcinoid, we're really limited because the only approved drug we have is octreotide, and it's a disease that's not thought to be particularly chemotherapy sensitive. I should say that liver-directed therapy is another category that's considered both in pancreatic neuroendocrine as well as carcinoid. And that plays a role in various patients depending on the extent of their liver involvement. But I would say for carcinoid, octreotide definitely plays a role both because of its known properties to reduce hormone-mediated symptoms in people with elevated 5-HIA, but also because of the documented cytostatic effect it can have, certainly in midgut carcinoids. So in those patients, I will often watch patients up front if they're asymptomatic. I will start octreotide in somebody who has a functional tumor up front. In either case, if somebody has progressive disease and they aren't yet on octreotide, then that's typically my first-line therapy. If they progress despite that, then of course we'll consider regional therapy, such as embolization. And then again, this is assuming the patient doesn't have resectable liver disease, for example, in which case we'll always involve a surgeon to discuss the role of resection. And then if somebody's progressed on octreotide and they have, for example, extrahepatic disease or they aren't a candidate for regional therapy, then our options are very limited. And at our institution, we're lucky enough to have access to clinical trials, and so we'll often explore that for patients. There are some data for everolimus from the RADIANT 2 study, which was a randomized trial looking at everolimus in patients treated with sandostatin LAR and carcinoid. And in that study, there was improved progression-free survival. The drug's not approved for this indication. It has Category 3 recommendation level on the NCCN guidelines, so sometimes we'll consider that in patients where that's, or we're looking for additional therapy.
Let's talk about some of your cases to get a flavor of how you approach this, beginning with this 87-year-old lady.
Yeah, so this was a case I thought was interesting to talk about because this is a patient who presented 15 years ago with a bowel obstruction at the age of around 70 and at surgery was found to have a tumor in the small bowel and an associated mesenteric mass, and all of that disease was resected and the patient recovered nicely from surgery. But what happened over the ensuing years was the patient was found to have recurrent disease in the abdomen and the lymph nodes, and really, in fact, has done quite well over the subsequent 15 years with slowly progressive disease in the lymph nodes as well in the supraclavicular lymph node area. The patient has slightly elevated urinary 5-HIA, but is entirely asymptomatic with no carcinoid syndrome. And while we've discussed the option of starting octreotide, particularly now that we know that it has a cytostatic effect, particularly in these patients, in the end, we felt that the risks didn't outweigh the benefits in this setting of somebody who's now 87 years old and otherwise feeling well and asymptomatic. And I think it's a really good case to think about because it makes us realize that not all patients need therapy and some patients have extremely indolent disease.
So she's had metastatic disease for 9 years.
Yeah.
Wow, and no treatment. Mm-hmm. I see it's interesting that the original tumor was grade 1, Ki 67, 1%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so again, this would be the type of tumor most likely to have an indolent course, but it certainly is an argument for holding off in the newly diagnosed metastatic patient and getting a sense of the biology of the disease before intervening.
So just hypothetically, if she were to develop progressive disease and you gave her octreotide and in spite of that she still had progression, in this particular 87-year-old lady, what would you be thinking?
That's a tough one because, again, other options in that setting, because this is extrahepatic disease, there's nothing standard in the setting, nothing approved in that setting. Interferon has been shown to be associated with a biochemical treatment effect more than radiographic response. But that's not a very well-tolerated drug, particularly in this age group. So that really wouldn't be something I was thinking. In a person with a good performance status, we'd always consider a clinical trial. And of course, age specifically is not contraindication to being on a trial. And again, as I mentioned, you know, lacking any firm data, if we're really pressed to try to find an agent, we might try something like everolimus, or again, in a very good performance status patient, we might try chemotherapy. But again, in somebody in this age group, particularly when quality of life is very important, and in this particular patient, it's hard to imagine a therapy that would provide a really meaningful benefit outside of what she's already. She had a very good quality of life over 15 years with the disease.
How about your 60-year-old patient with carcinoid heart disease?
Yeah, so this was an interesting case of somebody who actually presented in heart failure. So this patient's presenting symptoms were weight gain, fatigue, massive lower extremity edema. And in the ensuing workup, what became apparent is that the patient had normal left ventricular function, but evidence for both pulmonic and tricuspid valve disease consistent with carcinoid heart disease. Additional workup showed evidence for a cecal mass and extensive liver metastases, and a biopsy again showed evidence of well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumor with a Ki-67 of less than 1%. This patient had a very high 24-hour urine 5-HIA at 250, and in retrospect also had symptoms of carcinoid syndrome, including flushing and diarrhea.
And interestingly, in spite of this, sounds like kind of difficult clinical situation, when you look at it, again, well-differentiated Ki-67, less than 1%.
Yeah, so with these tumors that are well-differentiated, and in particular with the Ki-67 that's very low, presumably this is a tumor that had been there quite a while and was slowly progressive over time. And patients can often have fairly normal liver function tests, for example, despite having a large volume of disease. So it's suspected to be fairly indolent, and I would say it's fairly rare for patients to present with carcinoid heart disease. But that said, carcinoid heart disease is a very real problem in patients with functional carcinoid tumors and is something that one needs to be watching for over time as you're caring for these patients.
Can you talk a little bit more about what we understand in terms of the pathophysiology? I see here that she had a normal echo with left ventricular function, but as you said, severe tricuspid and pulmonary regurgitation. What actually happens?
Well, I think in sort of the very most basic terms, it's a serotonin effect on the right-sided valves, causing essentially fibrosis. Sort of along the same lines, for example, of some patients develop mesenteric fibrosis as well, which is thought to possibly be serotonin-mediated.
It's purely valvular.
It's purely valvular and generally restricted to the right side of the heart. And it can be both pulmonic and tricuspid valves.
Any theories why just the right side?
Presumably the serotonin is cleared by the time it reaches the left side of the heart.
That makes sense. And in general, what's the usual cardiologic approach and how is she approached?
Well, again, this will vary from patient to patient because much depends on the status of the rest of the disease. So many patients can have marked improvement of their symptoms simply by using diuretics. So that's always the first step, is to put someone on diuretics. And of course, we typically will involve a cardiologist in the process. And of course, adding octreotide, which can often improve things like flushing and diarrhea. And in this case, the patient had marked improvement of her carcinoid-related symptoms with octreotide. In somebody who has profound valve damage, another issue will come up is the role of valve replacement. And this is tricky because this is a very big operation. We have only recently explored the possibility of replacing at least the pulmonic valve percutaneously, but traditionally these are open procedures, which are very large surgeries. And so it's typically entertained in somebody whose disease is otherwise stable, in whom you think they're likely to benefit from such an intervention. And in this particular case, over the ensuing year or so, as the patient was medically stable and started on octreotide, she ultimately did have replacement of both the pulmonic and the tricuspid valves with really excellent improvement in all of her symptoms.
I'm kind of curious, what did she describe to you in terms of the flushing that she had and the diarrhea?
Well, the diarrhea can range from soft stools to watery stools in patients. In her case, she had multiple stools a day, sometimes related to what she ate. Flushing multiple times a day related potentially to exertion, stress. And typically patients will describe it as a warmth and a redness. And sometimes they can feel it coming on. Other times it's asymptomatic and a family member may see it and notice it.
How about your 60-year-old patient with a small bowel carcinoid?
Yeah, so this is a case of a patient who presented with flushing and diarrhea and ultimately was found to have evidence for liver metastases and an elevated 5-HIA. And this is a fairly common scenario where the liver metastases may be diagnosed either incidentally in the context of a workup for some other condition or because of a workup, for example, for suspected carcinoid syndrome, a case in which you don't know the site of the primary tumor. So our algorithm for working that up typically consists of doing, obviously, a CT scan. And in that case, we usually do a CT scan of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis looking for any sort of obvious primary site and with particular attention to the pancreas to make sure that we have good images. If that's negative, then in an otherwise healthy patient, we will consider an upper and lower endoscopy. And that is typically the extent of our workup. There are some who might advocate for capsule endoscopy or CT enterography looking for small bowel lesions, but I think that's somewhat controversial. In patients in whom you can see a mesenteric mass, such as a calcified mesenteric mass, that makes one very suspicious of a small bowel primary. In this particular case, in retrospect, the patient had had several episodes of severe abdominal pain in the preceding years leading up to the diagnosis. And I think this is a really important part of the history and something that one should always ask patients about because they may not be having the pain currently. But patients in whom you get that type of history, again, it really suggests an underlying small bowel primary that's intermittently causing obstruction. And in those patients, we will often consider resection of the primary tumor if it's known, or even an exploratory surgery to see if we can identify the primary tumor, because the hope is that you can prevent complications of the primary tumor if you can remove it, even though it's not necessarily a curative surgery, obviously, in somebody who has otherwise in place liver metastases. So in this particular patient, he actually did undergo an exploratory surgery, was found to have a small bowel tumor, which was resected, was placed on octreotide with excellent control of his carcinoid type syndrome. And then after a year of otherwise stable disease, he actually underwent resection of his remaining liver disease and was rendered disease-free, as far as we can tell radiographically, and has done well since and is just being followed clinically and radiographically.
But just to tease this out a little bit more, if I understand this history correctly, the diagnosis was actually made in terms of the liver mets, but the primary wasn't found until, what, a year or so later?
The primary, that's exactly right.
So initially it wasn't detected with colonoscopy and upper endoscopy, but actually it looks like he presented with an obstruction.
Yeah, but the obstruction symptoms can often be subtle and they can be intermittent. So it can be clear in retrospect what was going on, but it's not always that clear initially.
Any particular location that you see these tumors when you see presentations like this?
I would say the terminal ileum is very common in this setting.
Interesting. How about your 28-year-old man with pancreatic NET?
Yeah, so this is a case of somebody who presented with ultimately GI bleeding. So fatigue and anemia, and an upper endoscopy was found to have multiple duodenal ulcers. In addition, the workup showed a pancreatic mass as well as synchronous liver and bone metastases. Patient had a liver biopsy that showed well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumor, again with a fairly low Ki-67, which was around 5%. Tumor was positive for chromogranin and synaptophysin, which are characteristic neuroendocrine tumor markers. And in this case, the subsequent workup, again, directed by the symptoms and signs, included a gastrin level, which was markedly elevated at several thousand. So this case is very consistent with a gastrinoma. And the patient was started on a proton pump inhibitor as well as octreotide. And additionally, did pretty well, but ultimately, because of the bulk of the disease, the decision was made to start chemotherapy. And this patient actually had several months of capecitabine and temozolomide with actually very good radiographic response. Now, this was a very young patient, otherwise very well. At this point, with a desire to go off chemotherapy and a very bulky primary tumor, we discussed the possibility of resection of the primary tumor. And I would say that this is actually really quite controversial in somebody that has disseminated disease. And I think that that's a really important point to stress, that this isn't a routine thing to consider. In this particular case, because of the local involvement of this tumor and the concern for complications related to the primary tumor, the decision was made to do the distal pancreatectomy and splenectomy, as well as a cholecystectomy, because we knew that octreotide might be in the cards long-term, and there is a potential risk for gallstones on long-term octreotide, so we tend to remove the gallbladder anytime somebody's having surgery anyway. So the patient actually did undergo resection of the primary tumor because his disease was otherwise very well controlled. He was very fit, and we had this concern about complications from the primary eventually developing. And since then, which was now, this has been over 3 years, has done very well with stable disease everywhere on a bisphosphonate and octreotide LAR.
So let's spend the last few minutes talking about some other things. We could talk all day long about GINET, but I know you're also interested in GIST, and maybe you can tell me a little bit about this 50-year-old lady.
In this case, this is a patient presenting with abdominal pain and an ultimate workup revealing a PET-positive disease in the gastric cardia, as well as synchronous but limited liver metastases. And a biopsy of the gastric tumor revealed gastrointestinal stromal tumor with the characteristic CD117 or c-KIT positivity on biopsy. While we didn't know it at the time, eventually we did send the tumor for c-KIT mutational status, which showed the exon 11 mutation, which actually is associated with a fairly nice response to imatinib. And in fact, this is consistent with the patient's clinical course. The patient was started on imatinib at 400 milligrams a day as an upfront therapy, recognizing that the patient already had metastatic disease at diagnosis, and ultimately did very well, had a very nice response to therapy. And 9 months after starting therapy, the patient underwent a partial gastrectomy with removal of the primary tumor. At the same setting, had one of the liver lesions removed, and that was actually, it was a very dominant liver lesion that was very easy to remove in the setting of that operation. Additional liver disease was left behind, however, but that was ultimately resected about 9 months later to render the patient grossly disease-free. But of course, in the setting of gastrointestinal stromal tumor, we know there's a very, very high risk of recurrence after resection. And so the patient was maintained on imatinib after undergoing resection of all gross disease. And this patient actually has done quite well since that time, which is now 2 or 3 years ago, with the exception that there has been progression in the liver. And when that happens, sort of the algorithm really involves looking at where the progression is, the extent of the progression, whether it's a single site, a new site, et cetera. And in this particular case, the patient's disease was well controlled with the exception of a single site. And we actually did try a higher dose of imatinib, which can control disease in some patients, and it actually wasn't successful in this case. But again, because this was the only site of disease, we made the decision to ablate this lesion and actually put the patient back on the original dose of 400 milligrams of imatinib for two reasons. One, because that was a much better tolerated dose, and also because the disease was otherwise well controlled. And the patient's done well since.
So the phase 3 GRID trial presented at ASCO last year has now been published in The Lancet. And as you know, this study looked at the multikinase TKI regorafenib in patients with metastatic GIST progressing on imatinib and sunitinib. And in these 200 patients, they saw a progression-free survival advantage and pretty impressive hazard rate of 0.27. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I think, well, the regorafenib trial was in patients who had had at least prior sunitinib as well as imatinib. So at this point, while it definitely was effective in that situation and showed activity over placebo and is now approved for this indication. I definitely think it has a role, but at this point, we don't have data to say that it should replace sunitinib in the second line setting. So my practice would typically be to consider sunitinib after failure of imatinib, but I think regorafenib is definitely a drug that should be considered in the setting, and of course, future trials should help us to establish precisely the optimal way to use regorafenib.